there are many social political forces that want people to believe that homosexuals are just born that way and that they can't change. But there is much more evidence showing that people can change. There's a great deal of literature showing that individuals who are motivated can change even without therapy. Some people have spontaneously changed their sexual orientation. In fact, even gay activists will tell you that sexuality is fluid and fluctuates within the course of a person's lifetime.
That was Joseph Nicolosi before his death in March. He was a national figurehead of the gay conversion therapy movement. The Supreme Court yesterday upheld California's ban on gay conversion therapy, but it's still happening here behind closed doors. We'll find out more in a moment. First, though, German Chancellor Angela Merkel met with Russian President Vladimir Putin today in Sochi. Among other things, she urged him to protect the rights of minorities, and she talked about the reports that in Chechnya, gay men are being rounded up and tortured. More than 100 men have reportedly been arrested and sent to detention centers. According to Human Rights Watch, 3 have died. To learn more about what's going on in Chechnya, we're joined by Andrew Kramer, Moscow correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you. Well, yesterday, around 20 people were arrested. They were demonstrating in St. Petersburg against these detentions. What is the latest?
Well, the latest, as you mentioned, is that the German chancellor has now raised this issue with Putin. So we have a clear distinction between the way this is handled inside of Russia and the way that foreign governments are addressing the issue. The ambassador to the United Nations from the United States has objected. And now we have, at the highest level, a German complaint lodged with Putin. And that's really a very stark distinction, because in Chechnya, the response was almost as outrageous as the alleged abuses. And the response was that gay men do not exist in Chechnya, hence this cannot happen. The Kremlin has also denied any abuse or torture of gay men. But this is being taken very seriously abroad.
And so how are the reports coming out about what's happening in these detention centers?
To report a story on this issue, I traveled to Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, and spoke with officials there. I did not try to meet gay men because this would put them in danger. Instead, I met with gay men who fled Chechnya and are now living in safe houses. And I interviewed in depth 3 Chechen gay men who described their stories, which were quite harrowing. And this is how I wrote my report. I also based my reporting on Human Rights Watch and on the good work of Novaya Gazeta, a Russian opposition newspaper, which first broke this story about a month ago.
And what did these Chechens who fled and are now in safe houses, what did they tell you about what happened to them?
Well, what they told suggested a pattern, and this is that to find closeted gay men, the security services had posed as gay men looking for dates on social networking sites, and some of them were arrested in this way. They had struck up a conversation online, agreed to meet, and then were arrested. In other cases, gay men who had been arrested were compelled, under torture in at least some cases, to reveal the names of their lovers or their acquaintances, and then the police arrested these men. So these are really the same types of police tactics that are used in Chechnya against the Islamic insurgency, a very forceful and lawless law enforcement effort, which was designed and authorized to target Islamic insurgents, but in this case was being used against gay men.
And is there any idea why this is happening, why they're targeting gay men?
The best explanation is that the local leader in Chechnya has tried to co-opt some of the agenda of the radical Islamic underground to drain the movement of popular support. So, for example, in Chechnya, women are required to wear headscarves and other traditional measures, which are seen to be backed by a strict interpretation of Islam, are passed into law locally. And the antipathy for gay men is most likely part of this broader program.
And so why is Vladimir Putin tolerating this? I mean, I know that he led the effort to pass this restrictive anti-gay law a few years ago, but why is he allowing this expression of fundamentalist Islamic law to, you know, remain in Chechnya pretty much unchecked?
a number of abusive tactics have been allowed to take place in Chechnya. And one explanation is that the Islamic insurgency was a serious threat to Russia in past years. And this approach has worked quite well, of empowering a local leader, giving him carte blanche to act as he wants at home in exchange for loyalty to the Kremlin. And so they wouldn't want to break that agreement, as it were. This would be a local explanation of why the Kremlin has not intervened. More broadly, Putin has set himself up as a champion of conservative values in Europe, and he contrasts the type of civilization that Russia represents with what the EU or the United States represents, in part on the issue of gay rights, and saying that Russia represents traditional Christian values, or in the case of traditional Islamic values, and is opposed to gay rights as they've been developed and promulgated in Europe.
And so Russians outside of Chechnya, Russians in Moscow, St. Petersburg, elsewhere, how are they reacting to this?
Well, it's only been covered in the opposition press, so it's not widely known in Russia. However, the anti-gay laws, or the, more specifically the law against gay propaganda for minors, has been popular in Russia, and this could be embraced, although I would say that certainly the vast majority of Russians would be opposed to any sort of torture.
So the men that you talked to, they said that they were tortured in detention.
That's right. I talked to one man who had a sort of white, discolored skin on the palm of one hand and slightly less pronounced on the palm of the other hand. This was several weeks after he'd been in detention, and he said this was where alligator clips were attached to apply electricity to him during an interrogation in which he was asked for the names of his acquaintances who were also gay.
Hmm. So Angela Merkel today pressuring Putin to protect gay men and other minorities. How much influence is she going to have with him?
That's a good question. Maybe something quietly will be done. I doubt there'll be any public reversal, of course.
Andrew Kramer, Moscow correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court upheld a California law that bans gay conversion therapy. That law has been in place for 5 years and was the first of its kind in the country. It bans licensed therapists, doctors, and social workers from using conversion techniques on children, but it doesn't restrict religious leaders and religious groups from continuing the practice, which still happens here in California behind closed doors. Here to tell us more is David Cadell, one of the lawyers who helped draft the ban in California. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, this ban on conversion therapy in place since 2012. What was the problem that you were trying to stop?
Well, we were actually trying to stop a form of child abuse, and that may sound alarmist, but it's accurate. So all the major medical associations and psychological and psychiatric associations at the time that we proposed this bill came on board and advised that there was no scientific evidence that any effort to change someone's sexual orientation would be effective, but there were loads of scientific evidence that such attempts to change someone's sexual orientation caused severe psychological harm, including leading to depression and suicide and anxiety. And so there was lots of scientific evidence showing that this kind of effort by medical professionals caused severe harm without any evidence that there was actually any therapeutic benefit from such therapy.
And this ban only applies to children?
This ban in California, and there are similar bans in other states now, but California was the first, only applies to children. Now, that doesn't mean that in the future the community might not seek to impose limitations even on therapy that medical professionals seek to impose on adults. But when this provision was proposed, the effort that was behind it was to stop this form of child abuse, because children have no choice in the medical care that they are given.
Mm-hmm. So how does the state enforce this? If this happens behind closed doors, and let's say a parent takes their child to someone who agrees to practice this conversion therapy. Maybe this person is a therapist. Maybe this person is a therapist and a preacher and agrees to see the child not in office hours and not in an office, but somewhere else. How can the state enforce this ban?
Okay, let's start with the medical professional that is not also a preacher, okay? So
okay.
For the medical professional that's not also a preacher, that medical professional has a professional license, and they understand that they have to comply with all state laws. In this state, we license lawyers, we license doctors, we license psychotherapists, we license all sorts of people in the state as a state. And those professionals know that they are subject to the regulation of the state. And so the mere passage of the law itself provides an extreme level of, it actually is the most basic level of protection because professionals know they are subject to the law. Any individual who is subject to any of these laws that regulate any of the professions can file a complaint, can file a lawsuit. The state can file a lawsuit. Local jurisdictions can, in some circumstances, file lawsuits. So the passage of the law is a huge measure in terms of regulating the conduct of professionals.
And to the best of your knowledge, has that ever happened in the last 5 years? Has there been a lawsuit or an investigation?
Well, there have been lawsuits in other parts of the country, okay? This law is quite prominent here in California, and everyone knows that it's out there. There have been other cases in other states. But the question that you asked previously about, okay, what about someone who is both a licensed professional and a preacher? That's an interesting question. But I want to just interpose that it's a common question. Lawyers, doctors, psychotherapists, psychologists have their professional roles, and they may have their side roles as well. So the law does not regulate what people do in their side roles. It regulates what they do in their professional roles. And though certain persons in certain communities that are desirous of engaging in this kind of counseling argue that they can't tell the difference between their roles, it's actually a common occurrence that everyone who is a licensed professional has to determine, okay, am I acting now as a lawyer or am I acting in another capacity? Am I acting now as a doctor or another capacity? Am I acting as a psychotherapist or mm-hmm. another capacity? It's a common question, and there are clear guidelines that each professional knows how to follow.
So, to the best of your knowledge, do you think that the law has prevented gay conversion therapy? Or has it just gone underground and it's being practiced in a different guise?
Well, one, I do think it has prevented it. I do think that licensed professionals are now fully aware that they cannot engage in this practice here in California without facing the threat of liability, either from a lawsuit from their clients or from a complaint from the regulatory boards that regulate these professions. I think it's extremely important. Bear in mind that whatever profession you're talking about, whether it's accounting, lawyering, doctoring, there are elaborate sets of rules that govern these professions. If you wish to engage in these professions, you have to obtain a professional license, and then you have to commit to following all these rules. And you follow the rules. And the existence of the rules have an enormous effect on the conduct of professionals who are licensed under them.
And when you were helping to write this law, this ban, did you think, okay, we can't make it a broad ban because then it would be subject to challenge on a religious freedom basis? Did you think that was going to be a major threat to this if the law had been worded broadly?
The law had been carefully crafted to avoid that problem. What the law addresses is the conduct of licensed professionals in their professions. It does not in any way address the conduct of ministers who are acting under their guise as ministers or any other religious professional acting as a religious professional. The law addresses medical professionals acting as medical professionals. It doesn't attempt in any way to tell people what they can say or do outside of their professions. But these are regulated professions. We couldn't have a society that had legal professionals, medical professionals, accounting professionals, if we didn't have a set of rules and governing bodies that could regulate those professions.
All right. I want to thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Cadell. He practices constitutional law here in Los Angeles. He helped draft the 2012 ban on gay conversion therapy in California. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think religious organizations should have the right to practice gay conversion therapy? Let us know on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how a major chicken producer violates safety rules and immigration law to bring you chicken nuggets. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you are a little squeamish or if you love chicken, this next story may not be for you. Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle, was about horrific working conditions and exploitation of immigrant workers in the meatpacking industry more than a century ago. Well, you could argue Case Farms is a modern version of The Jungle. But instead of Eastern European immigrant workers, now it's Central Americans. That's according to an investigation by Michael Graybell, reporter for ProPublica. He visited one of Case Farms chicken plants in Ohio for his story. And he interviewed workers who were severely injured on the job and others who lost their jobs and were deported after complaining about the working conditions. And Michael Graybell joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Well, tell us about Case Farms, because it's not a household name, but maybe the chicken ends up in familiar places?
Yes, Case Farms produces about 1 billion pounds of chicken every year for places like Kentucky Fried Chicken, Popeyes, Taco Bell. Boar's Head sells its chicken as deli meats in supermarkets, and even the U.S. government has purchased about $17 million of Case Farms chicken for the federal school lunch program. So even though it's not, the brand name that you might buy in the supermarket like Tyson or Purdue, you may have eaten this chicken and not realized it.
And it has 4 plants, one of which you visited in Ohio. What did you see when you were there?
So they took me in and actually showed me the whole process. And you kind of walk in and it's a kind of like a cold, rainy day because it's set at 45 degrees in order to prevent bacterial growth in the chicken. And there's just chicken everywhere, and workers are working very fast to both hang the chickens for slaughter and also to cut them into different pieces for during processing.
And that part is the dangerous part, that working very fast with knives and processing the chickens?
Yes. A lot of workers I spoke to have experienced pain in their hands. There's amputations occur because of the close quarters and the rapid use of knives. And we also looked at, the sanitizing of the machines. At the end of the day, there's people who have to come in and with high-pressure hoses spray off all of the grease, meat, and blood that has kind of collected throughout the day.
Oh, God. And so there's one young man you profile who lost his leg when he fell into a vat.
Yeah, Osio Lopez Perez was a Guatemalan immigrant. He was 16 years old when he started working at Case Farms. He worked actually for the sanitation contractor, and he had an ID. It was an ID of his a fake ID of his brother's that said he was 28 years old. And the company didn't really ask many questions and hired him, even though he looked very young, and even though his brother worked there, so they would have known that the pictures were the same. He is cleaning the machines one day, and he slips, and he falls into one of the machines, and it. The medical report said it literally ripped off his leg, and he now wears a prosthetic device.
And did he get any restitution or anything from the company?
So he gets workers' compensation through the Ohio State Board of Workers' Comp, pays part of the salary to help him recover in the meantime. But outside of that, it's very difficult to sue a company.
But you document that this plant is particularly egregious when it comes to all of the chicken processing factories, that it's been fined millions of dollars. It's been the subject of hundreds of OSHA violations. You quote the former OSHA head as saying, this is an outrageously dangerous place to work. So why are they outliers when it comes to safety?
So one of the things that was really interesting about the story is that they, you know, they've been the OSHA director said that they've violated OSHA laws for 25 years. Well, over that 25 period, they have also relied on these Guatemalan immigrants, Mayan immigrants, who they recruited from the farming towns in Florida. These workers had fled the Guatemalan Civil War, and Case Farms actually sent a van down there and started recruiting those workers to bring to work in their plants. And so for 25 years, they've had a group of workers who, you know, one would think would be very quiet about speaking up, would not want to raise a lot of attention, even if they did see things that were unsafe. However, what was really fascinating was this group of workers defied that stereotype on a number of occasions and got together and protested, held strikes, walked out of the plant, always over the same issues, going back to the 90s, line speeds, low pay, lack of bathroom breaks, having to pay for equipment that they're required to use. And each time, Case Farms found a way to investigate the workers' immigration status or otherwise use labor and immigration law to get rid of these vocal workers and prevent any sort of improvement that the workers were seeking.
So and this is going on to this day, or are these past cases?
Going on to this day. There was a similar incident that happened. OCL's accident happened in 2015. There was a similar walkout in another plant in 2015. Last fall, the federal OSHA came out again with an inspection and said, you know, the way that the workers were cutting the chicken, the speed at which they were cutting the chicken was so hazardous to workers' hands and arms that they should investigate and change those positions immediately because they were so unsafe.
And they deliberately hired these workers knowing or thinking that they wouldn't protest because many of them were undocumented. So they knowingly hired undocumented workers?
So that's what we would assume. But one of the things that I found is that there was numerous occasions over the years where Case Farms knew or should have known that these workers were undocumented. One thing I heard a lot is that some of the workers who got fired after protesting said, I worked at the plant under different names before, and they fired me before for my immigration status, but I was told to just come back with a new ID and they would rehire me. And that happened on numerous occasions. I talked to one worker who said he's worked at the plant under four different names. And then, aside from it just being individual human resources supervisors, I found three times over the course of those 20 years with Case Farms in which some sort of law enforcement action prompted workers to flee the plant, literally flee the plant, or not show up for work for fear of an immigration raid. Those incidents don't appear to have caused any sort of introspection or evaluation of the books. It was only after workers held protests that the company started investigating immigration status and would use it.
So when you brought up all of this and all of these cases of undocumented workers working in the factories or the plants and all the unsafe conditions and all the protests and all that, what did the managers say?
Well, the managers kind of acted somewhat surprised, which was a little weird. I mean, they were certainly very open in bringing me into the chicken plants and responding to all of my questions, which is somewhat unusual for an investigative reporter. But they said that they were unaware of these incidents, and it was almost like a parent hearing of his teenager's delinquency. They said, I hope supervisors didn't do that, but if they did, it was the wrong thing. And they said that kind of for many of the incidents that I mentioned, which they had to have known about to some degree because they were paying tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees to fight these workers' complaints.
Well, now you say that they're going to replace all of these line workers with a machine.
Yeah, it's not all of them. It's in one plant. They've gotten rid of about 70% of the workers who do this really difficult cutting job. With an automated machine that can do it faster. But it's something that doesn't work at all chicken plants. The technical aspects don't work on larger size chickens, for example. So for a long time, there's going to be workers doing this. And recently, the company has been relying on refugees from Burma and Bhutan And we've even, I sat one day last summer in the heat and saw a bus full of prison inmates show up to work at the plant.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your reporting. Really interesting.
Thank you.
Michael Graybell, he's a reporter for ProPublica, and you can read his story online there at ProPublica or in the next issue of The New Yorker. Coming up, how the Osage Indians in Oklahoma got rich from oil and then became the target of a murder conspiracy.
And you're talking about a population of only about 2,000. So the richest people per capita in the world were becoming the most murdered people per capita in the world.
Writer David Grant on how those murders led to the creation of the modern FBI. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Thomas Jefferson once called the Osage Indians the Great Nation. Well, that was before he began to push them off their ancestral land in the central part of the country, and they lost about 100 million acres. Then, after they were forced to move again in the late 19th century, the Osage had had enough. And so they bought some rocky, supposedly worthless land in what is now Oklahoma. Well, it turned out that land was far from worthless. There was oil in those hills, and lots of it. And that would make the Osage Indians very rich, and also the targets of one of the most shocking murder plots in American history. David Grann wrote about this in his new book. It's called Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. And when I spoke with him earlier, I began by asking him whether the Osage could have possibly known that there was black gold in those rocky hills.
The Osage had some hint that there was oil under their land, but nobody thought they were sitting on a fortune. And when the tribe was allotted in 1906, the policy was to break up reservations, divvy them up into parcels. The theory was to turn American Indians into private property owners. And of course, it also made it much easier to procure their land. But when the Osage negotiated that treaty, because they owned their land, they had a deed to it, they had more leverage than other tribes, and they negotiated very hard, and they put in the treaty what seemed at the time like a very curious provision, which said they will maintain all the subsurface mineral rights to their land, and which they did. And then most of their surface territory disappeared into the hands of whites, but they controlled the rights to all this territory beneath the land.
How did they know to get the mineral rights?
They were very shrewd. They had one of their greatest chiefs at the time, a man who spoke seven languages, including Latin. They had some hints there was oil. Now, again, they didn't have any sense that they were sitting upon a fortune, but they very shrewdly negotiated for this. And at the time, there were really only about 2,000 Osage who were registered on the tribal roll. And each one of them was given what was called a headright, which is essentially a share in the mineral trust. And initially, when oil began to flow more steadily by 1910, by 1912, you know, they might have received $100 every few months, then $1,000. And over time, it accumulated into the millions. And by 1923, in that year alone, they received collectively what would be worth more than $400 million today.
Wow. And so how did that transform them? How did that transform the community? What did they do with all that money?
They lived in mansions, these terracotta mansions often. They had servants, many of whom were white. They sent their children to study in France. It was said at the time, whereas one American might own a car, each Osage owned 11 of them. And of course, this belied longstanding stereotypes of Native Americans that could be traced all the way back to the first brutal contact with whites. And it provoked all sorts of strange reactions among many whites, envy, outrage. Reporters would head out to Osage territory and tantalize their readers with stories about the quote-unquote red millionaires and the plutocratic Osage.
The Red Millionaires. And so the other part of the story that is key to understanding what happened with these murders is that in the early 1920s, the government set up this guardianship system. And they basically didn't trust the Osage to handle their money.
Yeah, so, I mean, in very kind of typical fashion, with kind of the veil of enlightenment kind of concealed the fist of coercion. And so members of Congress would sit and hold hearings about the Osage wealth and treated them paternalistically as if they could not handle their money. And they literally went so far as to appoint white guardians to manage many of their wealth. And this really was a racist system. It was literally based on the quantum of Osage blood. So if you were a full-blooded Osage Indian, you were deemed, quote-unquote, incompetent and given a white guardian to manage your wealth, telling you where to buy toothpaste or what kind of car you could get. And this system wasn't only racist, it also created one of the greatest state federally sanctioned criminal enterprises because many of the guardians were crooked and ended up swindling money.
So like store owners would charge the Osage an exorbitant price for their goods.
Yes. There was known as two prices, one for the Osage, one for others. And a guardian would, for example, direct a purchase of a car at a particular store where he would have a relationship with the owner there, who would then give them a kickback. Mm. People would run for office and use this guardian system as patronage, saying, we'll give you a guardianship if you vote for me. Wow. So it was it led to a very crooked system.
Well, and there was a lot of intermarriage. Many Osage married whites, and some of whom were their guardians. Let's talk about the woman who is at the center of your book. Her name is Molly Burkhart, and she married a white man named Ernest Burkhart. And she was really in love with him?
Yes, from all indications from the record, she did love him. And she's really an astonishing woman. She, in many ways, straddled not only two centuries, but two civilizations. She was born in the 1880s in a lodge, which is like a wigwam, speaking Osage. And within a few decades, because of the oil money, she's living in a mansion. She has white servants. She's married to this white settler from Texas named Ernest Burkhart. And they do seem, at least outwardly, he seems to outwardly love her, and she believes that he loves her.
She believes that he loves her.
Yes, which is a critical point. And it was around this time in the 1921 when she and her family became a prime target of this murder conspiracy.
So this murder conspiracy involves Burkhart's uncle, this guy named William Hale. And
yes.
he was a master of reinvention, as you described. So he's originally this kind of roughneck, and he is able to style himself into this, I guess, town leader and just a leader in general. And he seems very sophisticated on the outside, very beneficent and generous on the outside. And yet he is the mastermind of this criminal enterprise.
Yes. So he, showed up in Osage territory at the turn of the century, as you say, just basically rags carrying a Bible. He began to accumulate land. He becomes gradually the most powerful figure in the community. He was known as the King of the Osage Hills. Meanwhile, his reinvention conceals a trail of blood. And what happened was he had directed his nephew, Ernest Burkhart, to apparently marry into the family. And then once he was married in, to begin to kill members of the family so that they can get the mineral wealth. And the reason this had to happen was because each Osage was given what was called a headright, which was the share in the mineral trust. And an Osage who had a headright, you couldn't sell or buy it. So you couldn't just outright steal it. You could only get it through inheritance. So it led to these very baroque, intimate plots that involved the man having children with Molly, living with Molly, always while hiding his true face behind this kind of smile. And Hale was the exact same way. He was a pallbearer at some of the victims' funerals.
Wow. And some of the victims, we're talking about Molly's family, her sisters start dying off one by one.
Yes. Shot or
poison, her mom as well.
Yes. In 1921, in May, Molly's sister, Anna Brown, disappears. She is found a week later in the ravine, shot in the back of the head. Her mother dies within 2 months. Evidence later suggests she had been poisoned. And perhaps even most shockingly, not long after that, Molly had another sister named Rita. And one night about 3 a.m, Molly woke up and heard a loud explosion. She went to her window and she looked out in the direction where her sister lived. And all she can see is this kind of orange fire rising into the sky. And where her sister's house had been, somebody had detonated a bomb, killing Molly's sister, her sister's husband, and a white maid who lived in the house.
And so all of these people presumably would have inherited Molly's head rights or her property. And so was the plot to kill them off all one by one before finally killing Molly?
Exactly right. Even the chronology of the deaths followed a systematic order because the inheritance got kind of funneled from one to the other and then directly towards Molly. And then the apparent plan was to kill Molly. And in fact, she is slowly being poisoned at a certain point.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with David Gran about his latest book. It's called Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. So let's talk about the second part of the title of your book. This all gave rise to the FBI, or the beginnings of the modern FBI as we know it. And basically, this part of the world is pretty lawless, and the FBI didn't exist in its current form at the time. How did this situation with all these murders, how did that alarm Washington and cause the Justice Department to say, okay, we have to figure this out?
Yeah, so these murders went on for years. By 1923, there were more than 24 murders of the Osage. A few of those who had tried to catch the killers were also killed. One attorney was thrown off a speeding train. The evidence that he had gathered on the case was then cleaned out of his hiding place. And the Washington Post at the time said what the Osage already knew, which was there was a conspiracy to kill rich Indians. And in 1923, after all this, the Osage issued a tribal resolution pleading for federal officials to step in. And it was at that point that the case wound up with what was a very obscure branch of the Justice Department, then known as the Bureau of Investigations, and which we would later know as the FBI. It would be renamed. And it became one of the Bureau's first major homicide cases, and it became one of J. Edgar Hoover's first major homicide cases.
And really, J. Edgar Hoover made his name with this case.
He used this case to help cement his reputation. Now, the official version is not always the same as the actual version. So The Bureau, for the first 2 years, badly bungled this case. At one point, Hoover tried to dump it back on state authorities because he couldn't solve the case. And then at one point, he got this informant, a guy named Blackie, and they were going to use him as an informant. He was an outlaw. He was in prison. They got him out of jail. He slipped away from the FBI. He robbed a bank and killed the police officer. And Hoover feared a scandal might actually undermine his career. He had these dreams of a bureaucratic empire. And it was at that point that he turned the case over to a frontier lawman, an agent named Tom White.
So Tom White is the one who cracks the case, finally.
Yes, of course he gets no credit, but yes. He puts together a undercover team from a group that was known as the Cowboys. And they go in undercover. They pose as cattlemen. One poses as an insurance salesman. And they are ultimately able, by following the money, especially in Molly's case, to track down William Hale and realize that it is the king of the Osage Hills and his nephew, Ernest Burkhardt, who are responsible for many of these murders.
Well, I guess looking back in hindsight, you'd think, well, how would they have gotten away with it when they see how many people died and then where the money ended up? But for a long time, it didn't seem like anyone was really interested in prosecuting these murders.
Yeah, one of the reasons these murders went on for so long was because there was great neglect on the part of white authorities, because the victims were Native Americans. They were not treated as full human beings. There was also an enormous degree of corruption. And Hale and his nephew could rely on and count on. Hale assumed he would never be caught. I mean, he just thought that his power insulated him. And in fact, he had enormous power. And one of the great challenges wasn't just catching him, it was actually trying to convict him.
Yeah, so the trial is actually very difficult. There's a hung jury at the beginning, and then he's prosecuted again. But then he ends up not spending the rest of his life behind bars.
Yes, and in many Osage, he spends about 2 decades in jail. He should have died in prison for his crimes. It's outrageous that he didn't. And many Osage believe he kind of called in his last political favor to finally get out of jail. But even worse than that is that the Bureau ended up focusing on Hale and a notion that there was a singular evil figure, along with his accomplices, who were responsible for these crimes. But there really was a much deeper and darker conspiracy that the Bureau never exposed.
So how many people were killed in this conspiracy?
So it's very hard to put an estimate on it. The official estimate was more than 24, probably around 27. But scholars and historians who have looked at this estimate the death toll in the scores.
The scores.
And you're talking about a population of only about 2,000. So the richest people per capita in the world were becoming the most murdered people per capita in the world.
So when Molly finds out about this plot and realizes that her husband was at the center of it, what was her reaction?
You know, I still can't fully fathom it. I mean, she really did think he loved her. I mean, they had had children together. And this involves such an intimate level of deception. She sat in the trials. Initially, she was convinced her husband could not have been part of this. And you could understand why. Who could fathom somebody doing this? And it's only after she sits through the trials and begins to hear all the secrets that she comes to terms and reckons with the fact that the man who she thought loved her had been plotting against her, and that William Hale, his uncle, was in fact this deeply murderous figure. And of course, she then divorces him. She'll never see him again. Descendants told me that when she even heard his name, she would retreat in horror. And during my research, a lot of it was archival, but I also tracked down the granddaughter, Molly Burkhart, a lovely woman named Margie. And she told me stories and what it was like, especially for her father. In fact, she gave me a photograph that showed her father with Ernest Burkhart when her father was a little boy. And her father, or Molly, had ripped out the top of the picture that had Ernest's face. And her father used to refer to Ernest Burkhart, she told me, as old dynamite, because he was part of the plot that blew up the house of Rita Smith. And in fact, there was a belief within the family they were supposed to be in that house that night too and be killed. And because her father had an earache, he happened to not be in the house that night.
Oh my gosh. So he didn't even call him his dad or his father.
No, he called him old dynamite. Huh. I mean, just imagine that. And when you speak to the descendants, you really get a sense of how this is living history and how it still reverberates even three generations down. You still have descendants of the murderers and the victims living in the same neighborhood, intertwined. And so this really is, to me, this is a story, this is a microcosm of this clash that we don't often want to reckon with between Native Americans and whites that took place in this country. It played out in a very modern form, but it really is in many ways part of the story of America, where you can have the descendants of the victims and the descendants of the murderers now living in the same neighborhoods.
Well, David, thank you so much. It's been such
thank
a pleasure.
You. Thank you. It was great to be on the program again.
That's David Graham. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the new book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. Coming up, shark. You might be hearing that word more often. There are more great whites off our coast these days. We'll find out why next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A shark attack over the weekend at San Onofre Beach has left a woman in critical condition. And since then, there have been a few reports of shark sightings at beaches along the coasts of Orange County and Long Beach. The weather is warming up. We are headed to the beach. How concerned should we be about getting in the water? Ralph Collier is president of the nonprofit Shark Research Committee and author of Shark Attacks of the 20th Century. And he's here now. Hello.
Hello, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, you've been tracking shark behavior for a few decades, right? A long time.
Well, since 1962.
Oh, okay. For a very long time. So have you noticed an increase lately in the number of great whites along our coast?
Well, over the past several decades, their population has increased. To what degree, we don't know, because we can't go out there and count them as you would horses in a corral. Mm-hmm. But we know their population has increased. They've been protected for a little more than 15 years now. So their population's going up. But what we're looking at with these numerous reports we have, encounters, sightings, things of that nature, has to do with population dynamics in that ocean user groups, their populations have increased substantially in the last.
And by ocean user groups, are you talking about people?
I'm talking about surfers, divers, swimmers, kayakers. There are locations, as an example, in La Jolla, where during the 60s, I would venture down there to do some work. And there would be, on a weekend, on a Saturday, there would be maybe 10 or 20 divers in the water. You go down there today on a Saturday or Sunday, there might be a couple of hundred divers in the water.
Hmm.
And that doesn't count the bathers. And now we have ocean-going kayaks that can be rented. And right around the corner from all of this is a little SEAL haul-out site. And it's not uncommon to see a SEAL hauled out on the rocks down there in La Jolla with a nice big bite. To them from a shark. So
okay, so you're saying that the increase in encounters is because people are just seeing them more because there are more people in the water. Are there more sharks, though?
Yes. As I said, the white shark population is increasing. To what degree, we really don't know. We know that there are more of them today than there were 10 years ago, simply from the reports that we receive and from the locations where we are receiving these reports. So we know their population is going up. How many are out there, we don't know. But we do know that we have substantially more individuals utilizing the ocean, and therefore we have more potential observers out there. It's not uncommon for me to get a report of a shark at, let's say, El Porto, a sighting, and I'll get three or four in one day from individuals down in that area.
Hmm.
And it's not that we have three or four sharks. It might be these individuals are all seeing the same shark as it swims up and down the coast.
And how do you know if it's the same shark?
Well, that's the whole problem. You don't, unless you can look under the water and take some specific photographs of a white spot that they white sharks have on the lower lobe of their tail. Then there are other coloration areas that we use for identification. When they're young, you can use a dorsal fin. The trailing edge of the dorsal fin has specific cuts in it, and we can use that for identification. But unless you have that, you could be looking at the same shark three or four times within a given area of, say, a couple of hundred yards.
And are these mainly juvenile sharks, or are these the fully grown great whites?
Most of these are juveniles. They're yearlings, neonates, newborns. Right now, there was a photograph posted the other day of three sharks in the photograph down at Capistrano Beach. And they appear to me to be about 3.5-4 feet in length, maybe a little more than that. And the three sharks are swimming very close to one another. And I think that probably could be sharks from a litter where a female has come in and given birth. She's pupped. We know they pup in Southern California. And this is the time of year when that starts taking place.
So after they pup, where do they usually go?
The adults generally move on. They don't stay in the area. The problem we have with adult white sharks is that one of their primary prey items are pinnipeds, seals and sea lions. And the population of seals and sea lions has exploded in the state of California over the last 10, 20 years because they're protected since 1972. And now, last year, NOAA estimated that there are 400,000 seals and sea lions in the state of California. They did a census count on San Miguel Island in Santa Barbara County last year and estimated 35,000 harbor seal pups were born. So of that available food, you're going to concentrate.
Why would they leave? Why would the sharks leave?
Exactly.
So when they bite humans, are they mistaking them for seals?
Not generally. Most of the attacks on humans, kayaks, surfboards, and people, most of them, based upon research that we've done now for over 50 years, most of the attacks are investigation. You have cases where it could be a predatory attack where the shark is attacking the object because it has assumed that it's a prey item. And then you also have lumped together in a little category, sometimes referred to as displacement behaviors. You have things, threat displays, things like that, that the shark will undertake when it feels threatened, when it maybe is defending an area for pupping or food.
But it generally doesn't want to eat people.
No, no. We're not on their diet.
Right.
We're not a natural prey. Very, very seldom have we ever found human remains in a white shark. And only on a couple of occasions have we actually found a human inside of a white shark.
Ooh. Okay, so but people are a little freaked out after this attack over the weekend and other sightings. What do you think that they should do to protect themselves against a possible shark bite?
Well, the odds are extremely remote. You probably have a better chance of winning the lottery than being attacked by a shark. But having said that, there are certain things you can do to minimize the potential of having an encounter with one. One thing would be if you know sharks have been sighted in a specific area over a period of several days, don't utilize that area. Go someplace else. When you're in that area, just be alert to what's going on around you. The ocean will give you clues. Sometimes fish will jump up out of the water. That generally means there's something chasing them below. Don't wear brightly contrasting colors in your bathing suits when you go in the water. White sharks have the same ratio of rods and cones in the retina of the eye than humans have, so they can distinguish those shades of colors, and it might actually attract them. Don't wear jewelry. The sun will reflect off of that and will give flashing signs, which could be mistaken by a small shark to be a fish.
Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there with your shark tips. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Ralph Collier. He's president of the Shark Research Committee, also author of the book Shark Attacks of the 20th Century. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.